ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Fanu Filali again from Background Briefing. We're back with another incredible human story. Today, a grieving father and his relentless pursuit of justice after the devastating loss of his baby girls, Chloe and Darcy, in tragic but preventable circumstances. It's an indelible story, and the reporter, Alex Blucher, was named Journalist of the Year in Queensland as a result of this astonishing investigation. But before we start, just a heads up. What you're about to hear includes graphic and confronting descriptions involving the neglect of young children, and it also has some strong language. So listen with care.
First word she said to me, "I've left the kids in the car."
Peter receives the call that blows up his world.
"How long were they in there? Are they breathing?" She said, "No." I said, "Call a fucking ambulance," and I hung up. Ran red lights, ran over roundabouts, even past a police car. My focus was just getting there, and nothing was going to stop me.
He pulls up a couple of minutes later and runs inside a fibro suburban house.
I bolted upstairs. I ran into the bathroom. I could hear the shower going. And as I come around the corner,
inside is his daughter, 2-year-old Darcy Helen, and her sister, 1-year-old Chloe Ann.
Everything sort of went silent for like a second. And I'm looking at Darcy, and Darcy's looking back at me.
The two baby sisters died in their mother's car on a searing hot day in November 2019.
An outpouring of grief and sadness for two little lives taken in the most tragic of circumstances.
Last year, their mother, Kerri-Ann Conley, pleaded guilty to their manslaughter. She was later sentenced to 9 years jail. The full story behind this tragedy has never been told, but Peter and the family are now ready to speak, and they want answers. Chloe, Darcy and their mum were known to Queensland's Child Safety Department. So why, despite multiple warnings, did the department fail to prevent the deaths of the two toddlers? It's 2016 and Peter Jackson is surrounded by boxes.
I was moving house.
Peter's in his late 30s. He's a single dad of two teenagers and works as a long-haul truck driver. He's just moved into a new home. As he's contemplating the boxes, someone walks through the door.
A friend came over and brought another person with them. In walked in this blonde-haired, blue-eyed stunner.
That blue-eyed stunner is 24-year-old Kerri-Ann Conley. 2 weeks later, Peter gets a call from her.
She actually rang me and wanted to know what I was doing and wasn't doing anything, so she came over.
Peter gets to know Kerri-Ann. She's outdoorsy and he immediately loves that about her. Kerri-Ann is also into cars and travel, doing odd jobs along the way. She's worked in the Northern Territory and also South Australia for a time. They hit it off.
Yeah, well, she liked fishing too, so, you know, that was a no-brainer. We used to go out in the boat a lot. Four-wheel driving, you know, we did all the normal stuff normal people do on weekends, and she was fun. Like, got on with the kids. Yeah, just an easygoing, happy-go-lucky person.
Peter's mum, Deanne Power, remembers one happy day on the Gold Coast.
Kerri-Ann was fishing. I don't fish. I don't like touching the bait or the fish. And so they were all fishing and I was just sitting there making fun of them, and Peter was just being his normal self and being a fool, as he tends to do when he's having fun. So I was just sitting back laughing at him, and yeah, so it was a nice day.
Kerri-Ann moves into Peter's modest brick home in Crestmead in Logan, south of Brisbane. Soon after, Kerri-Ann's pregnant. As the due date approaches, Peter stumbles across something in the cupboard that makes his stomach turn.
I found a glass pipe and a decent wad of little bag things.
The items Peter's found are used by people who smoke crystal meth, also known as ice.
She wasn't home at the time, and so I sat them on the bench and waited till she came home. And then I asked her, what's this? She said, it's not mine.
But Peter's worries after finding the ice pipe are put on hold when Kerri-Ann goes into labour. After an emergency C-section, Darcy Helen Conley is born. It's the 14th of May, 2017. Mother's Day. Kerri-Ann and Peter bring Darcy home and enjoy those heady first few days with their little girl. But the newborn bubble soon dissolves. Peter notices Kerri-Ann behaving strangely. She's leaving the house during the night, she won't tell him where she's going, and she's taking Darcy with her.
Like, I started to question a lot where she was going, particularly at ungodly hours of the morning. And it was winter, so she's taking Darcy out in the cold too. You know, I was seriously asking serious questions.
Things escalate. The arguments get worse.
One response I got was, why are you trying to control me? I said, I'm not trying to control you, but I'd like to know where my daughter is. And why you feel the need you have to take her out at 2 o'clock in the morning in July. Now, it's 3 degrees outside. It's 28 degrees inside the house. Why do it?
One morning, Peter is getting ready to leave for work when he is confronted with shocking news. Kerri-Ann is leaving for good and taking two-month-old Darcy with her.
Just as I got to the door, she asked me if I would help two guys load a truck with her stuff. She was moving out. My heart hit the floor.
She was so tiny, the little Darcy, and she was orange, so that's how she got the nickname, because she had jaundice, so she got nicknamed Pumpkin.
This is Kerri-Ann's older half-sister, Kirsty. When I speak to her, she's juggling her two-year-old on her knee. Kerri-Ann and Darcy moved in with Kirsty after leaving Peter. Kirsty's never spoken publicly about what happened, and I can tell it's hard for her. She tells me that Kerri-Ann, like all new mums, could be really attentive and protective in some ways.
She always had a nappy bag and it was all lined up with, you know, nappies, and everything had a spot and couldn't be out of place. And if it did, she'd get cranky about it.
But Kerri-Ann would struggle in other ways. Kirsty remembers one night. She's at home and she hears Darcy screaming from Kerri-Ann's bedroom.
I could hear Darcy crying and Kerri-Ann was in the bedroom with her boyfriend asleep, and that Darcy was in between both of them. Darcy was screaming and I was like, no, I've got to stop interrupting, you know, I've got to let Kerri-Ann be the mother. And I was like waiting and waiting.
Minutes pass. She can't take it any longer.
I tried to wake Kerri-Ann up. She wouldn't wake up. Her boyfriend wouldn't wake up. So I just took Darcy and took her back into my room and fed her and changed her and put her back to sleep. And then Kerri-Ann woke up about 11 o'clock the next day. She had a 16-hour sleep.
Kirsty has a serious conversation with Kerri-Ann and urges her to quit drugs.
I'm like, Kerri-Ann, you need help. And she just flat out refused and say she can give up if she wants to. And I'm like, well, give up. You know, you got a kid to think about. But it'd go in one ear and out the other, basically.
Kirsty worries, what if she wasn't there? Darcy could get infections from dirty nappies or go hungry. Or even worse, Kerri-Ann could roll onto her in bed. Soon after this incident, there's a visit. It's officers from Queensland's Child Safety Department. They want a meeting with Kerri-Ann about Darcy's welfare. Someone has dobbed her in for taking drugs. But Kerri-Ann makes excuses, and the officers agree to come back the following day. Peter makes a dash for the house.
It looked like a fucking bomb had gone off. There was shit everywhere. I said, right, eh? What are you on? She told me marijuana. I looked at her and I said, don't treat me like a fucking idiot.
Peter continues to question her. He doesn't believe her denials.
I said, now what are you on? And she told me meth. Well, she told me she was a recreational user.
The next day, the officers arrive for the meeting. They ask Kerri-Ann why Darcy is being taken out at all hours of the night.
Kerri-Ann showed them Darcy, showed them her toys, and said, yeah, I do go out at night time, but I'm allowed to.
What did child safety want at that point?
They just wanted to come in, do random checks, just to check Darcy's welfare and to get any basis behind the claims that had been made.
But things quickly ratchet up.
To them wanting her to do drug tests, that she wasn't allowed to have Darcy on her own. She had to have somebody there with Darcy all the time. So if Kerri-Ann was bathing Darcy, somebody had to be there and feeding her, a safe person had to be there.
That safe person is Kirsty. But with her own child to look after, she can't be there all the time. So another friend of Kerri-Ann signs up to help.
But she was one of Kerri-Ann's drug friends. And then that's when shit started really hitting the fan.
What do you mean by that?
Basically letting Kerri-Ann do whatever she wanted instead of having the safe person constantly with Darcy.
Meanwhile, Peter calls Child Safety to find out what they are doing to protect Darcy.
And I said to them, I said, if anything's going to happen, Darcy comes home. She comes to me.
Weeks pass. He hears nothing. Then comes a smack in the face.
Then I get a phone call one afternoon from Kerri-Ann. They had turned up to take Darcy into care because she failed 3 drug tests.
Peter races to Kerri-Ann's house. He's furious.
I was ready to bury her where she stood, and I said it to her in her driveway. But, you know, it was a pretty intense time and emotions are high. Like, they're taking your child. Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it. And then that's when it really, really dawned on me and everything fell into place that, yeah, it was more than recreational. It was more than what she had told me.
Darcy's placed with an unknown foster carer. Peter is trying everything to get his daughter back. He takes drug tests, his house is searched, and his teenage children are questioned by child services. Peter's name isn't on Darcy's birth certificate, which means he needs a DNA test to prove he's the father. But Kerri-Ann makes domestic violence allegations against Peter to child safety officers.
Was there any DV? Did things ever get violent?
No, nothing. Nothing. Never touched her, never, nothing. Nothing. She had told them that I was abusive because I, you know, raised my voice. And like I said to child services, of course I'm going to raise my voice. You've got drugs around my child? Bet your ass I'm going to yell at you. And they told me I couldn't do that.
We haven't been able to hear Kerri-Ann's side of the story because we aren't allowed to speak to her in prison. Kirsty says all she ever saw was some intense arguments between the pair.
And I know he did get angry at her and there was some abusive phone calls, but, I mean, I don't blame the dude. I would have yelled and screamed too.
With child safety refusing to give Peter custody of Darcy, all he gets is 1 hour a week.
He was heartbroken, and he was really annoyed that child safety didn't go through with helping him.
It's approaching Christmas 2017. Darcy has been in foster care for close to 3 months. Under pressure from family, Kerri-Ann tries to stay away from drugs. And it works. She moves in with Peter for a while and passes several drug tests. It's enough for child safety to hand Darcy back to Kerri-Ann. But child safety sets some ground rules.
She had to remain clean. Kerri-Ann was not allowed to be on her own for the first 2 months with Darcy. It was either myself or another family member had to be with her constantly. If she was to go out, Darcy did not go. That were the rules. She didn't like them, but she did them.
With Darcy back at home and Kerri-Ann off drugs, Peter begins to see a future for them.
Are you in a big truck? Cheese!
Darcy is sitting in Peter's lap in his big B-double truck.
Brum, 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 brum. Happy.
She has curly blonde locks and is loving being with her dad. Peter cherishes his time with her.
Big personality for such a little child. Very big. Yeah, them blue eyes. That looks straight through you. Yeah. If she wanted something or wanted to get into something, she got it. She got it. Yeah.
Together with Kerri-Ann, they all have a special Christmas day at Peter's mother's house. Deanne, known as Nana, is very warm and cuddly. Her house is full of family photos, toys, baby bikes, and there's a big swing set in the backyard.
Darcy was the most cutest thing I'd ever seen. She was so tiny and happy, and she just, yeah, and I picked her up and she sort of felt comfortable because I think she knew I was Nana. Oh, that was a fantastic day. We were all happy.
That Christmas, Kerri-Ann remains off drugs. But soon after, she becomes difficult to contact again. Peter doesn't see Darcy for another 2 months. Child safety's involvement begins to wane. Their visits are shorter and more spread out. No case plan is developed, and the drug tests are less frequent too. Peter suspects Kerri-Ann's beginning to regress, so he keeps trying to contact her.
Yeah, one day out of the blue, towards the end of February, I got a phone call from her. You want to come around and see your daughter? So I left work early, and I went. And you know, spent the afternoon with Darcy, and then Kerri-Ann went to grab my hand, and I said, oh, look, I gotta go. So I left. And I don't think I'd quite made it back home. I think I was only 5 minutes from home. And she rang and told me she was pregnant.
It's someone else's child.
So that was a hard thing to take.
Around this time, a new child safety officer is assigned to Kerri-Ann. But in July 2018, she refuses to work with child safety altogether. And soon after, child safety closed her case. Kerri-Ann moves on with her life without the oversight of child safety. And one night, 3 months later, she shows up at Peter's. She's in labour. On October 10, 2018, Chloe-Ann Louise Conley is born. Peter and Kerri-Ann have a talk and decide they'll look after the girls together.
Things were great. I had the perfect job. I had the girls. I had Kerri-Ann. I had my kids. It was good. It was good, you know. When I was home, everyone was here on the weekend. It was just one big family. It was great. It was great.
Slowly, a routine sets in, and Peter has both girls some weekends. On occasion, Kerri-Ann would sleep over too. And while Peter's not Chloe's biological dad, it doesn't matter. Peter has a nickname for all his children, and Chloe's is the kid.
Sort of, she had the blonde hair and blue eyes too. Yeah, cheeky smile.
And Chloe loves being Darcy's little shadow.
Oh, Darcy had a trike with a trailer on it, and Chloe would crawl into the trailer and Darcy would tow her around the house. And that's what they would do for hours on end. And you just hear them laughing, giggling, and yeah, until they were thirsty or hungry.
Towards the end of 2019, Peter suspects Kerri-Ann's drug use is worsening, but he can't prove it. Then on one Saturday, November 2, 2019, he gets a phone call. He's told there's a drug party at Kerri-Ann's house. Peter's in the truck, driving back to Brisbane from North Queensland. He tries to call a couple of times, but there's no answer. He heads straight to Kerri-Ann's house from the truck depot.
I turned up there unannounced and I walked into what looked to be the end of a drug binge night, and there were people everywhere. In the lounge room, there was pipes, glass pipes all over the place. There was bags, empty, them little empty packet things, and just people strewn all over the place. And I could hear the girls down the hallway.
Kerri-Ann is asleep in the house.
Where were Darcy and Chloe at this point?
In their room, confined to their room by that baby gate. So whatever they'd been smoking in that house that night, all the doors, all the inside doors to all the bedrooms were open. So all that smoke and whatever else is drifting through that whole house, and all the outside windows and doors are shut. So yeah, whatever went on in that house that night, the girls were breathing.
Peter is ropeable and tries to take both girls home with him. Kerri-Ann won't let him take Chloe, but says she'll bring her over later that night. She doesn't show. What happens next is a key moment in this tragic case.
I got woken up with a text message from Kerri-Ann. Was putting everything in the car to come over, including the kid. I woke up at 2 o'clock and Chloe was still in the car. Oops.
Peter couldn't have known it at the time, but this message would prove to be an omen of things to come. Kerri-Ann had walked inside her home and fallen asleep, leaving one-year-old Chloe strapped into the back seat of her car. She was left in there for hours. This time, the cooler night air saved her. Peter is horrified and worried. He wants a doctor to look at Darcy and make a report to child safety. He's seriously concerned about her exposure to drugs. Darcy's behaviour is hyperactive. She's running around and banging her head on the walls.
The girls had dark rings under their eyes. And Darcy was, she was petite in her frame, but for someone petite, you can tell that they're skinny or losing weight, and I noticed that. For a two-year-old or two-and-a-half-year-old to have rings, black rings under her eyes, yeah, that doesn't happen from lack of sleep in a two-year-old. No way.
Later that Sunday, Peter takes Darcy up to Logan Hospital Emergency. A doctor examines her and reports his observations to child safety, including concerns from Peter. She's been exposed to methamphetamines at her mother's house. The doctor's also worried about 2-year-old Darcy's diet, which seems to consist mostly of cow's milk. The next day, Peter, his mother Deanne, and sister Kelly all called child safety's intake team.
We told them that Kerri-Ann was on drugs. She was leaving the girls in the car. The house wasn't clean. The girls were undernourished. They weren't eating properly. Peter would give her money to go and buy food and she was using it on drugs. Or she'd have buy food and then she'd have her junkie friends over and they would eat all the food and then there was nothing left for the girls. So all they were getting was just their milk and, yeah, no attention.
We told them everything and they just wouldn't listen. It was like we were getting nowhere, you know. Probably shouldn't say it, but I work for the government, you know, but I couldn't do anything. I wanted them to go there and get Darcy and Chloe and then, you know, go through everything and put them with Peter.
2 days later, they still haven't heard from child safety.
Well, this is urgent and they weren't taking it as urgent. And that's what was frustrating me because I just had this gut feeling something wasn't right or something wasn't gonna go right. I had a feeling that the girls were gonna get hurt.
Peter's desperately trying to keep Darcy with him, but it's tricky because he's not on her birth certificate. He's torn about what to do. Pressure's mounting, he's receiving threatening phone calls from Kerri-Ann's friends, and in the end, Darcy is returned to her mother.
And I just said to her, to Kerri-Ann, here you go, here's Darcy, and I just said to her, just look after them, make sure they're safe. And we drove off and I was crying, Kelly was crying, and, yeah, it was so hard to just hand her over.
All I said to Darcy, because, you know, I thought Peter would get her soon, you know, after the amount of child safety calls that were made and, you know, him doing it the right way, I just turned around to her in her car seat and I said, I'll see you later, Pumpkinhead, and she just laughed at me.
Soon after, Peter approaches a legal practice. He's not giving up on the girls, and he's hoping a solicitor can help him get custody. He books an appointment for Tuesday, November 26. But he'll never make it to that meeting because just days before he's due to meet his solicitor, his world will change forever. It's Friday, the 22nd of November, and Kerri-Ann's at home looking to score.
That morning, we went over there. I gave her some drugs. And she told me to come back that afternoon.
This is Kerri-Ann's neighbour, Nicole.
We've gone over there and gone in and my stomach dropped when I walked in there. I thought she'd already done something, but she hadn't. They were in the bath and she was in her room smoking pipes. So my friend went in the room with her and I stood at the bathroom door watching the girls in the bath.
Nicole shuts Kerri-Ann's door to stop Darcy and Chloe breathing in the fumes. The bathwater is cold.
Darcy's started to go to sleep. Her head rolled back, her eyes started going all weird. So I grabbed her out and wrapped her in the towel and told Kerri-Ann to dry her and dress her. And because, I don't know, she took too long, obviously, because then Darcy's peed everywhere and she threw her back in the bath. And then Chloe was in the bath in a nappy. Kerri-Ann came in and took the nappy off and the pants off that she had on. And she had really bad nappy rash, like really bad.
Kerri-Ann dresses Darcy and Chloe. It starts getting dark, so she gives Chloe a bottle of milk.
Yeah, I rocked her to sleep and then put her in the cot in the room. Walked out and shut the door and she was asleep, so she was fine.
But Darcy won't go to sleep.
Darcy had a red cordial bottle and Kerri-Ann said to me, why won't she go to sleep? So I took the bottle and I tipped the red cordial out and put milk in it. And it calmed her down.
Can you describe the scene in the house?
A pigsty. there was cots everywhere. There was about 5 cots filled with shit. There was just cat food and milk in the fridge. That was it.
As they're going to leave, Nicole notices that Darcy puts her hands up in the air, wanting to be picked up, but Carrie-Anne shuts the door. Nicole doesn't report to child safety or the police. That night, Carrie-Anne heads out again with Darcy and Chloe. She's hanging at a friend's house until the early hours of the morning. Carrie-Anne arrives home just after 4 a.m. and goes inside. But she leaves the girls strapped in her black Mitsubishi. While she's in the house, she sends a final text message at 5:55 and after that, falls asleep. As the sun climbs, so does the temperature. It gets as hot as 33 degrees that day, and inside the car, it's almost double that. Carrie-Anne emerges from the house at 1:20 p.m. By then, the girls have been strapped in the car close to 9.5 hours. On CCTV footage, Carrie-Anne can be seen taking the girls inside. First Darcy, then Chloe. She then gathers up evidence of drug use and throws it in a bin outside her house. Only then does she call Peter. She tells him she'd left the girls in the car.
I said, how long? And just like 5 questions at once before I even got an answer out of her. How long were they in there? Are they breathing? She said, no. I said, call a fucking ambulance.
Peter arrives before the ambulance. He speeds into the driveway at 100 kilometres an hour and leaps up the stairs into the house.
I could hear the shower going. And as I come around the corner, the first one I saw was Darcy staring at me. Everything sort of went silent for like a second, and yeah, I'm looking at Darcy and Darcy's looking back at me, and she was pale, like a yellowy pale colour. Her eyes, they look smoky. And she had a long jumpsuit on, like a zip-up jumpsuit thing, and it was zipped down to her, unzipped to her belly button. Her lips were a purpley-grey black colour.
Carrie-Anne is standing in the bathtub with the water going. She's on the phone to the paramedics. Peter drops to his knees to Darcy and sees Chloe out of the corner of his eye. She looks the same.
And everything's just, after that split second of silence, everything was just loud. There was not one particular noise, it was just loud. So I started to do CPR on Darcy. I'm pretty sure the paramedics were instructing Carrie-Anne what to do with Chloe.
For a moment, he thinks she's breathing.
And I heard the breath, and at the time not thinking, just in full panic mode and adrenaline and everything going on around me, not realising that was my own breath that I'd put into her.
He keeps going and going. The paramedics race in and grab the girls.
He actually had to shove me out the way. And as he looked at her, I heard him. This is probably the only words I heard. I heard him go, oh, fuck. Picked her up and bolted. So I went to Chloe and I started on Chloe, and then another paramedic came in and shoved me off her, grabbed her and and went.
It's just Kerri-Anne and Peter left in the bathroom.
Like a split second, I looked at her, at Kerri-Anne. She turned the tap off. And I said, how long were they in the car? She told me an hour. I'm glad she lied to me.
His head is spinning. Peter walks outside. He can barely make out what people are saying.
When the paramedic came over and said, no, that's it. They've passed away. And that was it. I just fell apart. And then I had two detectives come straight up to me and escort me to their car. At that moment, I felt like I was the only person on the planet.
Kerri-Anne was not interviewed as part of this program. Queensland law prevents journalists from interviewing prisoners without permission. When we sought permission, it was denied by corrective services, so we were not able to hear Kerri-Anne's side of the story. It's been more than 4 years since Darcy and Chloe's deaths, but for Peter, the anger is still raw. He blames Kerri-Anne, but says Queensland's Child Safety Department is also responsible.
They failed them. They haven't just failed Chloe and Darcy, there's other kids there. How many more times do we have to see this sort of thing when, if the parents are failing, that's supposed to be a backup to protect these kids. But if the backup's failing, what happens then? We're just going to watch them all die? That's wrong.
In the next episode, we hear from inside the Child Safety Department and reveal the damning detail of what went wrong in the lead-up to Darcy and Chloe's deaths.
Why wasn't something done sooner to take the girls away from her? If somebody just had listened, that Peter would have Darcy, at least, and Chloe would be in custody, or they might have even given her to Peter as well, to keep sisters together, and it'd still be alive.
Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Isabella Troppiano. Fact-checking by Ben Sveen. Our supervising producer is Mario Christodoulou. The executive producer is Fanu Filali, and I'm Alexandra Blucher. You can subscribe to Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app. Thanks for listening.